I first went to Pakistan in 1975, and I drove there from Germany, where my parents were living, in a little Chevrolet Vega, bright orange car, across Turkey, across Iran, across Afghanistan, over the Khyber Pass into Afghanistan to the sleepy town of Peshawar, Pakistan, which was a sort of one-horse town at the time, Tongas, one old hotel from the British colonial times, a beautiful residence that we had there. The wife of the consul general was a landscape gardener, and it was just a very, very elegant but calm, sleepy place where you could sit and have a gin and tonic on the porch. And you know, have a good dinner time conversation with well-educated Pakistanis, and no worries, you know, no worries about bombs or violence or whatever. At that time, South Asia was a half a world away. If you were involved in it, the State Department, it wasn't a front and center kind of issue. We were always a little bit frustrated by that, because it was during the Cold War, and the important places were Russia and Europe and so on, but certainly not South Asia. But needless to say, over the last couple of decades, that has changed, and Pakistan really is an important country today. And let me just explain why. First of all, it's very big. It's 180 million people and growing. And there's a large English-speaking labor force, and it's in a strategic location. It borders Afghanistan, China, India, and Iran. You know, a lot of very important countries. And Pakistanis will often say, you know, you can choose your friends, but not your neighbors. And they do believe, with good reason, that they live in a very dangerous neighborhood. Pakistan has the seventh largest army in the world. It's been very active over the years in peacekeeping, and it now has 140,000 troops on the border of Afghanistan. Pakistan is a Muslim democracy. It has a very solid constitution, written in 1973, and it has the potential to be a force for modernity and moderation in the Muslim world. It has a large and very successful diaspora in the United States, many very successful medical personnel, financial people, business people, very active in their communities, active in politics, many of them second generation, and they have a strong lobby on Capitol Hill, and they're very nice and interesting and successful people. Last but not least, it has nuclear weapons, which makes us all stand up and pay attention. But as much as that, it's a beautiful country. When I was there in 1975 to 1978, I had the opportunity to drive all around the country, the mountains, the desert, the shore. Wonderful place, hospitable, interesting, varied. So I came to really like Pakistan. I like Pakistanis. I have a lot of Pakistani friends. But I'm kind of in a minority now, particularly in the Washington policy community, because Pakistan is a bit of a troublesome friend to have in today's world. And let's face it, the headlines about Pakistan are bad. You hear talk of a failed state, you know, a pariah state, and so on. Most often you read about terrorism, you read about the violence there, and after all, Pakistan was home to Osama bin Laden for about close to 10 years before we found him. There are also local Pakistani terrorist groups. There's a Pakistani Taliban that regularly attacks government facilities, police stations, army facilities, and so on. There are terrorist groups that attack India. One of the groups, the Lashkar-e-Taiba, was responsible for the horrendous attack in Mumbai in 2008. And there's just a lot of violence in the city of Karachi, targeted killings. There's now a lot of sectarian violence between the Sunni and Shia Muslims. And it's too much for the security forces to handle. So this is an issue that's very much on everybody's minds. Pakistan is also in an economic crisis. You might have read about what they call load shedding there, which is rolling blackouts. They do not produce enough electricity. Complicated reasons for this. It's not that they don't have the capacity, it's just a very poorly managed sector. But it's a big problem with a big effect on the population and on industry and industrial production and so on. They're on the verge of a balance of payment crisis. They're currently negotiating with the IMF. This is a huge problem. So economically, even though they're resource rich, they've become very dependent on donors, bilateral, the international financial institutions, and so on. It also has poor governance. They don't deliver services well, health, education, and so on, let alone electricity. And of course, there's a lot of corruption in the government, and a lot of the money doesn't go to the right places. They're not alone in that, but it's a big problem there. And they're behind in terms of human development indicators. Literacy rate's only 55%. And of course, it's a lot worse for women than for men. And it's a region that's disaster prone. 2005, there was a massive earthquake in the north, which over, in 10 minutes killed 85,000 people. 2010, there were floods that stretched along the Indus River from the northernmost part of the country all the way down to the ocean. So with all of these problems, Pakistan's hard work if you're in the U.S. government. So it's not surprising that not everybody, particularly people who didn't see Pakistan in a more peaceful time, are struggle to deal with it and figure out what to do, and it's the last place in the world they want to go, frankly. It's interesting just to take a minute to look back at Pakistan's history, because it wasn't always this way. At independence in 1947, Pakistan was on a par with every other country in the region. They were ahead of the now so-called Asian tigers in terms of human development indicators like literacy and so on. They had a very capable civil service. They had a strong military. They had a very effective local government system that the British had developed. They had the largest irrigation system in the world in Punjab province in the central part of Pakistan. And most important, people often forget that Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, Jinnah's vision was for a pluralistic and progressive country where citizens of all faiths would be treated equally. There's a famous phrase from the speech he gave at independence, August 11, 1947, where he said, "You are free to go to your temples, your mosques, or any other place of worship." So the image was not an Islamic republic and was not of discrimination against Christians and various sorts of Muslims, which you see today. It was not to be a sectarian kind of country. That wasn't the original idea. And at first, as I say, it wasn't an Islamic republic. It was a dominion under the British crown until the 1950s. And Sharia law, which has brought such things as blasphemy laws and what they call the hudud ordinances, which punish women for adultery in a most cruel way. None of that came along until 1978 under General Zia. So in the 50s and 60s and in the beginning of the 70s, Pakistan was really a model developing country. They had a planning commission which had been helped in its beginnings by people from Harvard University, one of the model planning commissions. They had high growth rates, green revolution. They developed with the help of a famous American agronomist, Norman Borlaug, particular grains of wheat and rice, which were much more productive. My favorite example is that Pakistan International Airways, which now is totally broke and floundering, was a model airline, helped in the formation of Qatar Airways, if any of you've ever flown that, and Emirates, two of the best airlines in the world now, out of the Middle East. PIA helped them get started. They built major infrastructure projects. Two big dams in which we participated, Tarbela Dam, Mangla Dam, big projects for power and irrigation to help the country develop. And so they were, in the development sense, doing everything right, and they had very good relations with the U.S. Pakistan was a Cold War ally. You know, the Indians had teamed up with the Russians. Pakistan had teamed up with us. And, you know, Kissinger flew to China from Peshawar in what was then the Northwest Frontier Province, which is now truly one of the most dangerous cities in the world. You can see photographs of Jackie Kennedy visiting Pakistan, driving up the Khyber Pass in one of her little silk sheath dresses and pillbox hats. It was really, it's wonderful to see these photographs. So it was quite a different place in that period. So the question is, what happened? What happened with Pakistan? I always say, first, Jinnah died. You know, he died right after independence. So there was no leadership, unlike in India, where Nehru was prime minister for nearly 20 years. Pakistan didn't have that continuity of leadership, and the individual who had the vision for a secular, tolerant society wasn't in the picture to lead things forward. Then they had a series of military governments, which weakened the whole idea of democracy and weakened civilian institutions. I think it's important to realize that it's not so much that these military governments were dictators or autocratic or whatever. I mean, they were that too, and some of them were better than others. But the real problem was they prevented democracy and civilian institutions from taking hold. The economy didn't go through the normal reform process through the 70s and 80s and 90s. It didn't complete the trajectory that it had started in the 50s and 60s. So you didn't have any land reform. It's still very much a statist economy. There are a lot of state-owned enterprises. The Pakistan International Airways is state-owned, but so is the steel industry, the cement industry, and so on. So they never got rid of that overhang, which is a big place for patronage, employment for the political parties and so on, but not efficient in terms of modern economic thought. They still highly subsidize food and fuel. They have a very narrow tax base. Less than 2 or 3% of Pakistanis pay income tax, so their tax is, the amount of tax they collect is only about 9% of GDP. So they don't have enough money and they're always broke, which is why they have to go to the IMF. An important thing, the population has grown three times since I first went there in 1975. The population then was 60 million. It's now 180 million. And one can't overestimate the kind of pressure that's put on your education system, your health system, and so on. And what happened was that conservative governments came in, war in Afghanistan and so on, and the whole family planning effort, which was common everywhere in the 70s, just sort of slid off the agenda. And then also, Pakistan was distracted by competition and wars with India and also with Afghanistan. Now, let me just say a couple of things about what the problem is with India and Pakistan or the problems between them. First of all, partition was very bloody. Tens of thousands of people were killed as Muslims left India to come to Pakistan, and Pakistani Hindus left to go to India. So this left a bitter taste on both sides of the border. Another issue which has yet to be resolved, which I'm sure many of you have read about at one point or another, is the issue of the state of Kashmir. Kashmir was a Muslim-majority state, so Pakistan expected that it would come to them during partition, but it was a princely state, and in the whole partition agreement, the princely states were given the option to go either with India or with Pakistan. And it so happened that Kashmir, had, even though it was Pakistan, it was Muslim majority state, had a Hindu ruler who chose to go with India. Pakistanis then, Pakistani tribals in the Kashmir region invaded India at the very beginning, and it just never got sorted out. And it's been a thorn in the side of both countries for a long time. And then some years later, when East Pakistan broke away from West Pakistan and became Bangladesh, the Indians helped the East Pakistanis. So this was a very bitter pill for Pakistan. Then when there was an insurgency in Kashmir because of Indian mismanagement of the state, basically, the Pakistanis started to help the insurgents in Kashmir. So again, there were tensions. And then both countries began to develop nuclear programs. India decided it needed a nuclear capability because of China, and they had fought a war with China in 1962. When Pakistan figured out that the Indians were doing this, of course, they started a nuclear program, and this was another source of tension between them. And then finally, in the last couple of decades, as India broke away from the Soviet Union, the Cold War was over, it became much more economically progressive, again, was no longer an ally of the Soviet Union, we began to look at India in a different way. It's a very big state, again, strategically located, the potential for us to balance China and so on. So we became more interested in India, and the Pakistanis were feeling a bit left behind in that, and it had the result of more tension between Pakistan and India. Then look at the Afghanistan side. Another distraction for Pakistan, which changed things dramatically, was what has become 30 years now or more of war in Afghanistan. First, with the Soviet invasion, what this did was to enable a sort of jihadi mentality to begin to grow in Pakistan. And remember, we were involved in this because we were supporting the Mujahideen, but we were doing it sort of semi-covertly, or we wanted plausible deniability. So it was the Pakistanis who were actually providing the assistance that we were paying for to the Mujahideen, who were fighting the jihad against the Soviets. So this whole mentality, and along with it, madrasas and Sharia law and so on, began to take hold in Pakistan. The wars in Pakistan also empowered the Pakistani military and its intelligence arm, the Inter Service Intelligence, or so-called ISI. And this, you know, put pressure on Pakistan's democracy. And again, when you look at Pakistan and Afghanistan, you know, you wonder, what's the issue there? The Afghans really resent the Pakistanis. They think that they patronize them. They think that the Pakistanis are always trying to manipulate them. They look at the period when Pakistan was managing our assistance to the Mujahideen. They were picking which groups and which commanders and so on, and tried to manipulate things in the way that people who would be friendly to them got the most weapons and so on and most power. And so the Afghans remember that. They resent it. They see the Pakistanis supporting the Taliban now, which is fighting the current government. This, of course, makes them very exasperated. They resent the fact that Pakistan controls their route to the sea. They're a landlocked country, so much of the trade for Afghanistan has to go down through ports in Pakistan, and this, you know, causes a lot of frictions and tensions. For Pakistan's part, in a way, the Afghans are right. They do sort of look down on the Afghans. They think they're much more primitive and violent and so on, and they feel a slight sense of superiority, which is wrong, but it is there among some Pakistanis. But what really troubles Pakistan about Afghanistan is that the Afghans don't accept the current border, which was put there by the British, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. the so-called Durand Line. They don't accept that as the border. In fact, many Afghans think that the city of Peshawar, for example, the capital of the Northwest Province, now called Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, should be in Afghanistan. So they worry about the Afghans stirring up the Pashtun tribals, which are on both sides of that border, to try and get everybody to want to be in Afghanistan rather than Pakistan. So this is a big threat to them. They also fear Indian influence in Afghanistan. The Indians have a long-standing relationship with Afghanistan that, you know, goes back hundreds of years. But they hadn't been much active there until after 9/11, when we went into Afghanistan and they began to build their presence there. And this makes the Pakistanis very nervous. And the Pakistanis see President Karzai of Afghanistan trying to use the Americans and the American presence there to counter the influence of Pakistan. The Pakistanis resent that. So there are historical and contemporary tensions between the two countries. And then, of course, what else happened for Pakistan is that after the Soviets left Afghanistan, we became much less dependent on Pakistan, and after the Soviets were gone, we immediately put the Pressler sanctions on Pakistan because of their nuclear program. So throughout the 90s, we weren't giving them any assistance, and you know the rest of the world wasn't exactly making up for it, so they were a bit isolated. And then, of course, 9/11 came. We demanded their cooperation against Al-Qaeda, and they agreed, but the problem for Pakistan was that a lot of their own citizens saw them as a bit of a puppet of the Americans for agreeing to support the war on terror, which they believe brought a lot of problems to Pakistan. So tensions continued and then, of course, culminated in the discovery of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad and our raid. So that increased tensions between us and the Pakistanis and the rest of the world, frankly, that Osama bin Laden was found there. So that, in a nutshell, is what happened to Pakistan, starting off in a very promising way in the 50s and 60s, and then getting on the wrong side of a lot of issues from our point of view and the point of view of the rest of the world. So the interesting thing is, though, that all of this source of tension with us and the rest of the world, source of tension in the region, and source of tension within Pakistan and political instability, it does obscure some positive developments that have been going on in Pakistan over the last decade. Let me just mention a couple of those. First of all, Pakistan has just had an election, and it was the first time in their history that a civilian government has completed its term. Because before, there had always been military intervention, there had been coups, or one thing or another. So this time, there was an election which was, by reasonable standard, pretty much free and fair. There are some contested seats, but there were a lot of observers. And it wasn't stolen by anybody. The result was as anyone would expect. The previous government was thrown out on its ear because it was corrupt and not very effective at governance. And the party that had been in opposition, the Pakistan Muslim League and Nawaz Sharif, were voted in with pretty much a majority by the time the various independent parties joined up with them. They have a solid majority in the parliament. And the election itself was pretty impressive. I mean, I was there observing, and I always find elections in developing countries really inspiring because you see illiterate people going to the polls, you know, you see women, you see young people, you see a whole mix of people going to the polls, standing in line, casting their ballot, putting their thumbprint on, and then you see people counting these ballots by hand. I mean, it's a very impressive process. And the turnout was 55%, which was sort of like the same as our election. And everybody was a bit surprised by that because there had been a lot of violence in the run-up to the election. So people were a bit concerned that people would be afraid to go to the polls, but they weren't, and they came in droves. And, you know, some of the polling stations had to stay open extra hours. There was a little disorganization here and there, but they sorted it out. They got the ballots counted. They have a majority government, and it's really no mean achievement. This new government, with Nawaz Sharif, has economic reform very high on its agenda. So they're already working on an energy policy, which they're about to announce. They're negotiating with the IMF. They're sort of getting on with the business to try to make up for lost time on the economy, which is very encouraging, and it's encouraging to the public. It's encouraging to donors, potential investors, and so on. So that's going on. There is a lot of strength in the informal economy. You know, if you look at the statistics for Pakistan, you think, you know, how does the place survive at all? But in fact, a lot of the economy, you know, isn't really registered and it's not paying taxes and so on and so forth. But if you go to the rural areas, you know, you see where remittances have come back. You see, you know, quite prosperous areas because they're under the radar in terms of the formal tracking of economic progress. Civilian institutions are getting stronger. Again, we're so preoccupied with the security issues and the violence and so on, sometimes we don't notice. But the parliament has, in the last 5 years, become a lot more active. You know, they've organized themselves in committees. They have a very active defense committee and foreign policy committee. And, for example, when after the raid on Osama bin Laden, there was a lot of debate in the country over what their relationship should be with the United States. The Foreign Policy Committee debated this at great length, came out with a list of things that should be part of Pakistan's policy and so on. So they're becoming more actively involved. They've passed a lot of progressive legislation on women's rights and so on, and a very important piece of legislation on the devolution of authorities from the central government to the provinces. Over time, a lot of power had sort of accreted into the federal government, which wasn't the way the 1973 Constitution was meant to be, but it got changed by executive order and so on over the years, mostly by military leaders. And so the parliament was able to pass this legislation, putting authorities like for education and health and so on back to the provinces. And when you think of how large a country Pakistan is, 180 million people, you know, when you had an education ministry in the center where the minister could individually place teachers in various districts around the country, it wasn't very efficient. So that's a very important thing they've done. The Supreme Court has become very active. It's challenging the civilian leadership. It's challenging the military leadership, which is a real first. You know, the Supreme Court sent a bench of three people into Balochistan, where there's a lot of allegations of the military, killing Baloch nationalists and making people disappear and so on, and calling them to account. So that's an important indication that civil institutions are putting down roots. Civil society has become much more active in the last 20 years. You have NGOs, you have philanthropists stepping in to create low-fee private schools to make up for the absence of government schools or the low performance of government schools around the country. So you have people becoming much more active and taking more charge of their lives and services when the government doesn't step up. And then finally, you've got the media. You know, Pakistan has dozens of television channels, dozens of talk shows, and, you know, more, as many talking heads as we have. Honestly, it's fascinating to watch. And, you know, so they challenge the government, the military. They talk about corruptions. And election night, it was, you know, just like the United States. Every channel had its experts commenting, you know, as the early returns came in. And this really does serve to help people become much more aware of what's going on in their society and making the government sort of listen up because there's somebody watching. So you put all this together, and it's really democracy in action. You know, it's really the process that a country has to go through to sort of find its own style of democracy and to find the right balance among the various institutions of government and society. And even on these troublesome regional relationships that I was talking about, India and Pakistan are now actively talking about opening up trade. You know, and anybody who's an economist looks at South Asia and they realize for Pakistan and for India both, their trade is so minimalist at this point, and both countries could benefit hugely, and Pakistan, being the smaller country, could benefit even more through opening up the borders. And so they are working very actively on doing that. And the real key is that even the military, who are the most nervous about India, realize that they need trade with India to help the Pakistan economy, you know, without which their position in society can't be sustained either, because they get a large part of the budget, which is going to shrink if they don't get the economy growing and the tax base up and so on. So that's a very positive thing. The willingness to put economics above the political issues that have troubled them so long, like Kashmir. With Afghanistan, again, we found, particularly in the last year, that the Pakistanis are really trying to be helpful in promoting reconciliation among the various groups in Afghanistan. And the reason they're important in that regard is because they have influence. They have influence over various Taliban groups that have people living in Pakistan. And they, you know, so they've started to really urge, shall we say, these people to go to the negotiating table. This, I'm sure some of you at least read about the whole idea of a Taliban office being opened in Doha, in Qatar, in the Persian Gulf. Didn't quite work out in the first try, but I think it will, and part of the reason it will is that Pakistanis are really urging these people to the table. So there is some evolution in some of these very difficult relationships that have really caused Pakistan to be isolated, to isolate itself over the years. And then there's the youth in Pakistan, and this is just interesting as it is in many countries. Huge proportion of people in Pakistan are under the age of 30. They're becoming active in civil society. They were a huge vote bank, as they say in South Asia, over this last election. And many of them voted in a different way from their parents. You know, and this is, for a conservative society, a very interesting development. You know, they're enthusiastic for democracy. They're very patriotic as a rule, and they're creative and energetic and so on. So, if the economy can be made to accommodate the youth, you have a real force for change there. And you know, many of these people are choosing to stay in Pakistan rather than leave. And settling down there and trying to start businesses and make a life rather than going off to the West, the United States, the UK, or whatever. So all of these things should give us some hope for what Pakistan can be for the future. Now, what does this all mean for the United States? Because we're interested in, I mean, I'm interested in U.S. policy. That's part of my responsibility. And, you know, as I said at the beginning, Pakistan is an important country. It's an important country to the United States, whether we like it or not, and a lot of times we're very frustrated with Pakistanis, but it's an important country, so we need to figure out a workable relationship with Pakistan. So what is it that we want from them? In a tactical sense, we want help on counterterrorism. You know, we want help in finishing off the remnants of Al-Qaeda that are in the region. We want help in getting rid of the precursors for the IEDs, the improvised explosive devices, which were a problem in Iraq and now are a problem in Afghanistan, increasingly a problem in Pakistan itself. We want help on reconciliation in Afghanistan. As I mentioned, we're beginning to get that. We, of course, want continued help on the movement of our equipment both into Afghanistan and out of Afghanistan as we leave. This is an enormous undertaking, and we need the Pakistanis' help on that. We would like the Pakistanis to stop bashing the United States publicly. This is hard for us. We get a lot of criticism both from the government and from the public in Pakistan. It makes it hard. It makes it more difficult for our policy in Afghanistan. It makes it difficult for us with the Congress, for the executive branch. So we'd like that to be toned down. We'd like some appreciation for U.S. assistance. We've provided over the last decade, or since 2002, $20 billion in assistance to Pakistan, both on the military side and the civilian side combined. That's a lot of money, any way you slice it. But nobody ever seems to say thank you, and that's hard for us. We'd like what we would call a more responsible approach to the region, to India, which I, as I mentioned, was beginning to take hold, to Afghanistan, to the whole idea that South Asia, Central Asia, and further east should be linked. This should be one economic unit. We've talked a lot in the context of Afghanistan about a new Silk Road vision where Afghanistan can be connected to Central Asia, Pakistan, India, and further afield so that it's no longer so isolated as a landlocked country. So we'd like Pakistan to embrace that vision. And of course, we want them to be careful with their nuclear program. We want a safe and secure and responsible custodians of their nuclear capability. From the Pakistani point of view, what do they want? They want respect for their sovereignty. You know, as any small up-and-coming country, they're very conscious of being disrespected by anyone, and particularly big countries like the United States. So sovereignty was a huge issue with the raid in Abbottabad that got Osama bin Laden. You know, nobody had much sympathy for Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. It wasn't that. It was that we slipped into their country you know, killed him and other people and slipped out again, and they didn't know about it. And this was, needless to say, troublesome to them, even though secretly, I think a lot of them had enormous respect for what we've managed to do. They want recognition of their sacrifice in the war on terror. The Pakistanis have lost over 40,000 people since 2011. 4,000 soldiers, security personnel, and the rest civilians. So they believe they've paid a very high price and that we aren't sufficiently respectful of that. They want a responsible U.S. exit from Afghanistan. They are terrified that we're going to cut and run, that there'll be civil war in Afghanistan, that they will again get the spillover effects, they'll get the refugees, they'll get the weapons, they'll get the narcotics trade, they'll get all of that, and they are very, very concerned about that. They want access to U.S. markets. Interestingly, the Pakistanis themselves always say, we would prefer trade to aid. You know, we want an opportunity to sell more in your markets. We don't want just to be getting money from you and other donors. And finally, they want a strategic relationship status with the United States. From their point of view, they were our ally throughout the Cold War. They feel that they were sort of dumped when the Russians left Afghanistan and the Soviet Union collapsed and so on, and they felt that this was unfair, that they were used and discarded. So they want the status of being a strategic partner of the United States. You know, and when I look at these two sets of needs, requirements, demands on either side, I don't think it's really so hard to get there from here. I mean, we're really not that far apart. You know, obviously, Pakistan is a very different culture and society from ours, but we share a lot of common interests. We want stability in Afghanistan. We both want an end to the violence there. We both really want regional integration, expanded trade, economic progress, social project progress. The Pakistanis, I can tell you, are very, very interested in education. You know, you find people who clean houses in Islamabad, saving every penny to send their child to a low-fee private school so they can get an education. They understand the value of education. We appreciate that, and it's a value that we share. So the question is, what should we do? And, you know, I can't speak for the government of Pakistan, but for our government, you know, I think there are some common sense things that we should do and that we do, except sometimes we lose the plot. The first thing I would say is diplomacy 101. You know, stay engaged consistently with the Pakistanis. Don't send a bunch of people there and then for 6 months you don't talk to them about anything. And part of diplomacy 101 is recognizing their sovereignty, recognizing the sacrifices they've made, and recognizing the positive developments of the last decade or so. You know, not focusing on the negative all the time, focusing on the positive. We should, and we're trying to do this, but again, sometimes we don't, we should work with the civilians as well as the military leadership. And that might sound like perfectly good common sense, but I can tell you, 90% of the time when a congressional delegation comes to Pakistan still, they want to see the chief of army staff. They're not much interested in the civilian leadership. Why? Because that locus of power is perceived as the most important. But if we begin to give a little more recognition and have a little more engagement with the civilian side, we can have some influence on that balance. We need to focus our assistance on their priorities. Their priorities now are energy and infrastructure. Yes, education and health and so on are important, but from their point of view, that's more their issue. Where we have a comparative advantage and can be value added, it's on things that are high tech and where they can benefit from our special expertise. And they want our assistance to be big and to be visible. We should continue with and expand our people-to-people programs. In Pakistan, we have the largest Fulbright program, university exchange program of any country in the world. We have a lot of visitors that come here on various programs. We have military training and so on. And as someone who's been in the diplomatic and foreign policy business for many years, I can tell you, this is the best use of our money. When we deal with people from other countries, and certainly with Pakistanis who've spent some time in American communities, at American universities, whatever, it really changes their perspective. They really begin to understand us better and have more appreciation for who we are and what we're trying to do. And finally, we need to encourage the Indians, who, after all, are 7 or 8 times as big as Pakistan now, and who've done a lot more of the reforms and are a lot more progressive and further down the road than the Pakistanis are, to be a little bit more generous with Pakistan across the board. It's always up to the larger, more powerful country, I think, to help get the negotiation going. And we should encourage them to do that because we have good relations with India. So I think overall it's important to remember Pakistan is a young country, only 66 years since independence. And if these promising trends that I outline can continue, Pakistan and the rest of South Asia can become an economic powerhouse in the 21st century. And there's so much opportunity for U.S. investment there, and the opportunities for trade between Pakistan, India, Central Asia, and so on and so forth are really remarkable because they're starting from a low base for the reasons that I outlined. So there are still a lot of challenges, many, many challenges for Pakistan to overcome. But I think inherently, Pakistanis have the capability, they have the determination, they have the resilience to make a lot of progress. And it's really our responsibility where we can to help them do that because it's in our interest as well as theirs. And it's a very fascinating process from my point of view, and that's why I stick with it. As I said earlier, I like Pakistanis. I find them interesting, warm, very, very culturally complex society that they're from, and I hope to stay engaged. And I hope that this has given you a bit of a picture as to why the glass is half full as well as half empty with Pakistan. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Robin. We have time for a few questions. It's the usual procedure. There's cards at the end of the rows, and if you fill out a question, and the ushers, volunteers, will pick them up and bring them up, and we can get some of the questions asked. I'll ask the first question, which may be on some of our minds, which is, why is the approval rating for the U.S. and Pakistan at around 10%?
Otherwise known as the why do they hate us question, which we get in many parts of the Muslim world. You know, first of all, let me say that it is not because they don't like what we represent or they don't like our society or our culture. When Pakistanis come here, they love our democracy, they love the equal opportunity, they love the representative society, they love the openness, the friendliness, the meritocracy, all the things that we often think people don't like. In fact, the Pakistanis, and I think many others, actually like a lot. And as one Pakistani friend of mine who's is a very well-known writer said, you know, the problem with you, all you Americans, is that if you behaved abroad as you behave at home, you'd have no problem at all. Everybody would love you. So, you know, that's important. But I think the specific things are they do feel like whenever there's a crisis in the neighborhood, we use them. You know, we order them to help us out with the Mujahideen and the Russians after 9/11 with Al-Qaeda. And then when we're done, we leave and don't pay attention to them anymore. So they feel used. They feel that we don't respect their sovereignty, that we don't respect them as a government for some of the reasons I described. And finally, I think they, and this is their, you know, their own problem, they resent their dependence on us. You know, I mentioned the $20 billion a year. They, of course, wish that weren't so. And they're, you know, embarrassed to themselves about their inability to have marshaled their own resources so that they didn't need to depend on a big power like the United States. So I think those are some of the reasons. And, of course, there have been explicit things that happened where we didn't handle things in the best possible way. the Abbottabad raid was fine, except that afterwards we started bragging about it and saying, well, we couldn't tell those duplicitous Pakistanis and so on. So we kind of, what could have been something that we could have moved on from, we couldn't. We had a CIA contractor in Pakistan who killed two Pakistanis in the middle of the day in a crowded area of Lahore, Pakistan. That didn't win us any friends. We accidentally had a incident on the border in late 2011 where we accidentally killed 24 Pakistani soldiers and we wouldn't apologize for it. So these little things also leave a bad taste. I think, and there are things that they do that make us mad too, but I think that sort of covers the universe of why it is that we have a low approval rating.
Can you discuss the U.S. policy on the use of drones in Pakistan?
Since I'm a serving U.S. official, we don't recognize this program in any formal public way. But what I would say a couple of things. One, there is, and you can find this reading in the newspaper, so no secret here, that there is a lot of debate internally within the U.S. government and in the public about the use of unmanned vehicles. And, the basic question is, do we end up creating more enemies than we kill with these, with this technology? So there is a lot of debate. The president's intelligence guy made a speech about this some months ago, maybe as much as a year ago. And, of course, he's spoken himself about a new policy, so it's very much debated. And I will recommend an article by a fellow called Daniel Markey, M-A-R-K-E-Y, who's at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm sure you can find it online. If you can't, your children can, or your grandchildren can. And he discusses the whole issue and different approaches and how we might deal with this and use this technology in a better way.
You discussed Pakistan's relations with India and Afghanistan. What about China?
Very interesting. China is what Pakistan calls their all-weather friend. We're the fair-weather friend, and China's their all-weather friend. And, when India was friends with Russia, China was friends with Pakistan during the Cold War. So that's kind of how that all started. And the Chinese have done a lot of development work in Pakistan. They built much of the Karakoram Highway, a highway from the Chinese border, down to Islamabad. They do a lot of infrastructure. And, of course, the Pakistanis always say to us, well, the Chinese build us infrastructure. Why don't you? But I think, as much as anything, the Chinese don't make any demands on the Pakistanis. They never talk about human rights. They never talk about democracy. They support them in international organizations. They're not publicly critical. And they have been, again, very supportive in terms of infrastructure and development projects. So it's just a different type of relationship from us. And even though some of the things that Pakistanis do make the Chinese nervous, they're nervous about Pakistani support for various militant groups because they have Muslim populations on their border with Pakistan. So, but they never criticize Pakistan publicly.
As a last question, Secretary Kerry is in Pakistan this week. What is he doing?
Not talking to the Palestinians and the Israelis for the first time in 2 months. Secretary Kerry, as you may all realize, has had a long relationship with Pakistan, as he has with many countries. I mean, he's extremely well-versed in foreign policy and has personal relationships across the world, but he also has personal relationships in Pakistan, and he's been enormously helpful in the last couple of years at some of the crisis points. Certainly after the Osama bin Laden raid and when this CIA contractor killed these people. I mean, he's been very, very good at smoothing things down. So he has a reputation and a track record very positive in Pakistan. And he's basically what he's doing, this is a new government in Pakistan. He's been in the first, you know, senior official. The head of OPIC was there a couple of weeks ago, but, you know, the first sort of senior foreign policy official to visit there. And so he's trying to get the relationship with the new prime minister and new government underway in very positive terms. They've invited the White House, Secretary Kerry extended on behalf of the White House an invitation for Nawaz Sharif, the prime minister, to come to the United States in the fall so they can meet. He can meet President Obama. We're going to restart this strategic dialogue that we had in 2009, 2010. And, you know, as I said earlier, Pakistanis want to be viewed as a strategic partner of the United States. So this is a bow to that. Strategic dialogue means that we have some committees on specific issues, the economy, counterterrorism, and so on, that meet regularly at a high level, exchange views. This is something they wanted. So, you know, basically, he's starting off our formal relationship with the new government, and by all counts, just the press that I've read, he's doing a very good job of that.
Thank you very much.